It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's Pride Month, and today marks the start of Pride Weekend in Pittsburgh. The annual celebration of the LGBTQ community has an added special meaning this year because it's the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall riots that inspired what later became Pride. Joining us in studio to find out more about what to expect as part of this weekend's Pride celebrations are 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley and Environmental Health News reporter Christina Marusik. They are the co-presidents of the Pittsburgh chapter of the Association of LGBTQ Journalists. Welcome back to The Confluence.
Thanks, Kevin. Great to be here.
So this year's Pride's event. The events are spread out all over the city. Celebrations held multiple neighborhoods, including Shadyside, Garfield, downtown, Allegheny West on the north side, in the north side. It seems like it's going to be a really busy weekend. So let's start with, what do you think are some of the noteworthy events that Pride goers should attend?
Well, Pride is all month long, so there are a lot of events going on this weekend, but people should keep looking out for things that are going to happen throughout the month of June. But Friday, there is a block party in Shadyside in front of 5801. There's going to be drag performances and musical performances. It'll be a lot of fun. Downtown, Walk the Moon is going to be part of the Delta Foundation-sponsored Pride, and that's Fort Duquesne Boulevard and 9th Street. And then there's a dance party in Lawrenceville hosted by People's Pride. Saturday, there's more dancing. There's dancing all weekend long, so there'll not be a shortage of that. But there's also Toni Braxton performing downtown. There's a self-care day with the Sisters PGH and True Tea People, so you can get massage and just kind of be reflective. And then there's even more on Sunday.
And on Sunday, the People's Pride March starts in the Hill District at Freedom Corner and winds up at Allegheny Commons Park West. There's a performance from Big Frida that evening. And there's also the Pittsburgh Pride March hosted by Delta downtown at 11 a.m. And as a side note, in July, Pittsburgh Black Pride is hosting a number of events, so keep a lookout for those, too.
And we'll have a list and a link to all the events on our website, WESA.FM. You mentioned that People's Pride and Pittsburgh Pride. Pittsburgh has been the home to two different Pride celebrations since 2017. So remind us, how did this split occur?
So in lots of cities, there's a sort of main Pride celebration, and then there are a number of alternative Pride celebrations. And sometimes those are based on just different geography. New York has a Pride parade for every borough, or sometimes they're because of, you know, division within the community. So sometimes they're separate groups having different priorities.
Mm-hmm.
In Pittsburgh, the big split happened in 2015. The Delta Foundation invited rapper Iggy Azalea to come perform at Pride. And it had recently been revealed that she had a history of some pretty racist and homophobic tweets. So people took issue with the fact that she was coming to perform at our Pride celebration. And a group formed a separate Pride celebration called Roots Pride, which lasted for a few years. The organizers for Roots Pride, at least one of them, I think, has left the Pittsburgh area. And so after Roots Pride kind of wrapped up, it paved the way for People's Pride.
Katie, you talked with Sisters PGH founder Ciara Thomas about their commitment to hosting an alternative at Pride. Let's hear what she told you.
What I'm hoping to elevate is the murders of black trans women around this country, to highlight that and make sure that our allies, our friends, like our supporters around us are aware of that. And that's not getting erased through the corporate pride.
Ciara brought up the words corporate pride a lot, which is, in a lot of these cities, members of the community feel like they're being tokenized, feel like their pride is being monetized, and they're kind of feel like the celebrations are being sold out to big corporations. So Delta Pride a couple years ago has, you know, huge Walmart trucks, and they tried to be sponsored by EQT, like the natural gas company, and they tried to call it EQT Equality March. And
it actually was called that in 2017.
It was. Mm-hmm. And people had a huge issue with that because that's, you know, it's about the people. It's not about the money that goes into the celebration. And so People's Pride, you know, Ciara was, they describe themselves as explicitly pro-black, pro-trans, and intergenerational, which is what they feel is the other side of what Delta represents, which is a lot of events have been traditionally catered to affluent cis white gay men. They throw really extravagant parties and they have these big events that people of color and transgender people and non-binary people, gender non-conforming people, don't really feel like they have a space there.
Well, you mentioned the split has been going on for a few years now. Has there been any effort to unify, to come together? Been talks, meetings, anything?
So I reported on what happened in 2015 when Iggy Azalea actually wound up canceling her appearance after a lot of public outcry. And I spoke with one of the organizers of Roots Pride, which was the alternative pride in 2015. His name is Michael David Battle. And he said to me at that time that he thought, you know, the community is diverse and we should have celebrations that are equally diverse. Not one celebration is going to fit every member of our community. So it makes sense to have concurrent celebrations. And then I've spoken with, I interviewed others for that story who felt, Siora actually said she feels that there should be space for everyone in one unified Pride celebration. It's part of why they do their Pride at the same time, so that it's concurrent. Everyone's sort of downtown and celebrating at the same time, even if not in the same geographic space. So there's some effort to combine them, but really the idea is just making sure that people feel seen and accepted and comfortable while they're celebrating Pride.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're talking about Pride Weekend in Pittsburgh. Katie, you talked with Delta Foundation's Chris Bryan. Let's hear what Chris told you.
The community is extremely diverse and made up of a bunch of different people who have a bunch of different needs. And Pittsburgh Pride, we try to be as broad of a reach as we can. There's lots of other events that happen. We recognize we can't be all things to everybody. We do what we can and we do our part.
So Chris Bryan is talking about the community being diverse there. But are they responding to the diversity within the LGBTQ community?
A lot of people would say no. A lot of people would say there are still some significant issues with the structure of the Delta Foundation and with the events and the way that they run their events. A lot of people would say they still have significant problems with the way that Delta runs its events. They did make some efforts, Chris was telling me, to lower costs for vendors, to reach out to other organizations that they haven't traditionally worked with. And so I would say that's probably a good first step.
The Delta Foundation Saturday event, Pride Fest, has been moved this year. A lot of it's going to be taking place on the Andy Warhol Bridge. Is that correct?
Yes.
Why so? Why? I mean, we've seen festivals and celebrations on the bridge, but why move this to the Warhol Bridge?
So in the years that Delta Foundation has been organizing Pittsburgh Pride, they've grown it a lot. It's gotten really large. Mm-hmm. And public safety came to them and said, you know, I think this is too big and we would like you to find a new location. And they said, okay. And so they went to the Andy Warhol Bridge. And that bothered a lot of people. They said,
why so?
They said, well, it feels like you're taking us out of this very present, visible place. People felt like they were taking the event right out of the middle of downtown, which is very visible. It's been there for years. It used to have a lot of gay bars, Liberty Avenue,
right.
And that was kind of where they moved it to. And they also felt like it was kind of unsafe because there was one way in and one way out. But I also talked with Pittsburgh public safety officers and they said, you know, that's why it's going to be easier for us to maintain this event, because there's one way in and one way out. We can kind of corral the crowds in an easier way.
So is there a feeling that maybe community might feel boxed in even rather than spread out a little bit more?
I mean, physically, I think that was another concern I heard is, if you've ever been to an event on one of the bridges, like Picklesburg or anything like that, it's pretty tight. And especially if the event was moved because it's so large and then they move it to a bridge, people feel like it's going to be too crowded and just won't be enough space to move around and really enjoy themselves. So in that sense, yeah, I really don't think public safety meant to move it to the bridge to take the community out of downtown in the way that I think a lot of people are perceiving it. Because I did hear that when Pride events happen, they close downtown for 80 hours. They close that whole thing. And that doesn't happen for a lot of downtown events. If an event is going to last that long, they'll move it to Point State Park. But the Arts Fest almost always coincides with Pittsburgh Pride.
Right.
So you can't move it to Point State Park.
I mentioned this month marks the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Riots in New York City. Remind us briefly, what led to that uprising?
The Stonewall riots happened in New York City when police were raiding a gay bar, which was a regular occurrence at the time. And they went in to sort of bust up the crowd. They were usually sort of roughing people up. And the crowd at the bar was sick of it. It was, you know, the seventh night in a row where they'd tried to be safe and be comfortable in a place where they felt like they could. And the police came in, and instead of rolling over, they fought back. So there was some violence, and the perception was that the people at the gay bar won. And as a result, it led to several days of marches through New York City that are considered by many sort of the start of the modern day LGBTQ pride movement, along with concurrent events that were happening in San Francisco at the time.
So that was 50 years ago. Since the gay pride movement was born out of a grassroots movement, if you would, is there a call for, is there any traction within the community to refocus its direction?
I have a sense that there is. I think the Stonewall riots, the Stonewall events were started by transgender women of color and gender nonconforming people of color, and they're taking back that role. They're really getting on the ground, organizing their own events. And I think ultimately people have to remember that pride is about unity. And if one letter of that LGBTQIA is attacked, then everyone is attacked. And Ciora, when I talked to her about, you know, what's the mission of this year's pride, if there's something they're really she's really focusing on. And she said it's bringing up the fact that there are dozens of transgender women of color murdered in the United States every year. There were 26 last year. There've already been at least 5 this year. And that's the central point for this, is to say, yes, it's great that we've come all this way. We're doing all these great things. We have marriage equality. We have the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. But people are still being attacked. Transgender people, they've recently changed the prison regulations for transgender inmates. There's a ban on transgender people in the military. Student protections are being rolled back.
There's also still no federal workplace protections for members of the LGBTQ community.
Yeah. And so I think that resurgence of this, like, hey, we need to help everyone. We need to bring everybody, uplift everybody, is really coming back.
Reporters Katie Blackley and Christina Marusik are the co-presidents of the Pittsburgh chapter of the Association of LGBTQ Journalists. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. Pittsburgh stage actor Bingo O'Malley died earlier this week at the age of 86. O'Malley, a self-taught actor, had dominated local stages since the mid-70s and took on a range of roles in shows like Death of a Salesman and Glengarry Glen Ross. And a woman recently rescued from a closed hiking trail is facing a fine for the risky trek. The woman was extracted from the dangerous Glen Innoko Falls Trail in Lehigh Gorge State Park. Officials closed it last month following numerous deaths and injuries that occurred on this steep, slippery trail over the years. Find more online at WESA.fm.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The past year has been a tumultuous one for the Mattress Factory. The internationally known art museum was rocked by charges that it mishandled allegations of sexual misconduct. But while the Mattress Factory says it's moving forward, critics have questions. 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll reports.
On May 23rd, the Mattress Factory opened Laboratory for Other Worlds. The exhibit, by Brooklyn-based artist Patty Loper, was a room-sized installation of the kind the museum is famous for. Loper's work includes video and audio with a handmade feel and an outer space theme. The artist says she's long wanted to show work at the Mattress Factory.
I really just feel very lucky to be invited to do this.
It was a moment of celebration for an institution that hasn't had many lately. It's been 16 months since museum co-director Michael Olenek fielded allegations that a male employee had raped two female co-workers and sexually assaulted or harassed several others. In September, four current or former employees filed a federal complaint charging that museum management retaliated when they objected to how the museum handled the original allegations. Ever since, the museum has been working to improve in-house practices and show the public it's turning things around. Many think it's headed in the right direction. Visitors to last month's opening event included Laura Morgan, who lives nearby on the north side. Morgan said she knew of the Mattress Factory controversies, but still supports the museum.
I'm really lucky to have this as a neighbor. I get to come a lot. It's been very special.
Haley Haldeman is the museum's second interim director since Olenek was put on leave. Haldeman, a lawyer who was hired off the museum's board, started work in February. That was 2 months after the museum reached a settlement with the current and next staffers who complained to the National Labor Relations Board. Haldeman says the museum is well on the way to fulfilling its terms.
We've hired a full-time HR and business manager. We're in the process of revising our handbook, improving our annual review structure.
Haldeman said visitorship at the Mattress Factory has been strong, but there's also been a major exodus of staff. According to one former employee, about 30 full or part-time workers have left in the past year, including members of the senior management team. Haldeman says the museum is forging ahead.
We've had no trouble bringing in new people.
Other issues linger. For instance, employees have complained that the museum's board and management lack transparency, that they don't communicate their plans well. Haldeman says she's working on this, but perhaps the biggest example is the fate of Olenek. Critics note that he never even suspended the employee accused of rape and sexual assault. Olenek was also one of the managers accused of verbally berating employees who complained or denying them work assignments. Olenek has been on paid leave for 8 months. He's widely recognized for helping turn the Mattress Factory into a draw for artists from around the world. But some close to the museum say Olenek shouldn't be the one leading it. Annalena Kempen was one of the employees who brought labor charges against the museum.
If the Mattress Factory were to bring Michael back in a capacity of a curator or something similar, I would feel like the museum was saying, you know, this guy did wrong, but he's too important for us to hold accountable.
Kempen left the Mattress Factory in May, but she says morale was still poor, and one reason was Olenek's unresolved status.
The board's decision as far as what happens next will make a huge impact on what the atmosphere at the museum is going to be like, what kind of institution the museum is going to be, whether or not people can start rebuilding trust and management.
Some current Mattress Factory employees, speaking anonymously, say they feel the same. The museum is seeking a permanent director, says Haldeman. As for Olenek, she said, the museum's board is still deciding whether to part ways with him or bring him back in some capacity. Jen Gooch is a Pittsburgh-based artist who has taught at the museum and exhibited there. Last year, she stopped selling her work in the museum's gift shop in protest. Now Gooch is among those waiting to see who leads the Mattress Factory in the long run.
And I think that's where, as a community member, I feel like I'll be able to trust that things have gotten better there.
I'm Bill O'Driscoll, 90.5 WESA News.
Bill returns later on The Confluence to talk about the 60th annual Three Rivers Arts Festival, which begins today. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A new report on rural roads from the National Transportation Research Group, TRIP, confirms that our rural roads and bridges are not in such good shape, and they haven't improved all that much in the past few years. The report comes a couple of weeks after the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation decided not to spend $200 million originally intended for improvements for rural roads. Ed Blazina reports on all things transportation for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and he joins us now. Welcome back to the program, Ed.
Thanks for having me.
Ed, as you were looking at the results of this study, what do you think are some of the key takeaways regarding Pennsylvania's rural roads, that they're 12th worst in the nation, or the condition of rural bridges? What stood out to you?
I think what stood out to me, and it seems to be the same case nationally, is the number of deaths that happen on rural roads.
Safety factor, then.
Safety factor. It seems that almost triple the rate per million miles driven on rural roads as compared to urban roads.
Is it wideness? Are we comparing different things in the types of roads?
It's that. It's also the lighting isn't nearly as good. The roads are narrow. They're not as well maintained. They often have tree canopies that keep out what light there is in that area.
So those beautiful tree canopies can also be maybe creating decline in safety then?
Yes. I lived up in the Oil City area for a couple of years, 35 years ago.
Right.
And you could go out onto a country road there, and if you turned off your headlights, it was pitch black. Now, hopefully drivers don't turn off their headlights, but that's how difficult it is to see in some of those areas.
All right. If you live in or around Pittsburgh or even Philadelphia, you have a picture of the roads, the bridges that we have here. But in a state the size of Pennsylvania, we're talking about a lot of rural roads and bridges in between those two urban centers, aren't we? I mean, we might not think about it, but there are a lot of these rural roads.
Oh, sure. You go into Potter County or Bradford County, and it's almost all rural roads.
So what is a rural road?
The federal definition of a rural road is 2,500 people in a given area. The population is a driver of usage, along with some areas do have manufacturing or other types of production businesses. Farms do a lot of business.
So what is it? What makes the condition of these so, I don't want to say alarming, but important to the people who use them?
In some cases, are the only way to get from one place to another.
So you'd have a detour many, many, many miles, if
yes,
at all?
Very much so. Bridges in particular are a problem because there often aren't a lot of ways across rural streams other than the two-lane bridge in an area. PennDOT just recently completed a program where they bundled 558 bridges that were small bridges, gave them to one contractor who's going to maintain them for 25 years.
Is that the Rapid Bridge Replacement Program?
Yes. And that concentrated on small bridges, many of them in these rural areas, that go without attention for a long time. And they're critical in the areas where they go bad.
What about industry? What about truck drivers? Are they using rural roads, and how so?
Absolutely they are. Farms that produce large amounts of product,
right,
have trucks carry their product out of the area. Any area that has shale gas has a lot of particularly water trucks going in and out of the area.
For the fracking process, yeah.
Yes. And I know in some of those areas, the fracking trucks do a lot of damage. And the companies pay to maintain those roads because they're critical for their business.
Is that part of the impact fee or is that a separate thing? Because the idea of the impact fee was to help some communities whose infrastructure was being damaged.
It can be both. In mm-hmm. some areas, the impact fee isn't enough to keep the roads in the shape that the companies need them, so they contribute additional money to help take care of those roads.
So it's the drilling companies, it's in their best interest to kick in some bucks to make sure that they can get their trucks in and out.
Absolutely.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're talking with the Post-Gazette's Ed Blazina about his reporting on the state of rural roads in Pennsylvania. Ed, are the rural roads more difficult to maintain? Is there a difference in how PennDOT treats rural roads versus city roads?
There's a very big difference. Are they more difficult to take care of? No, not necessarily, but the standard isn't the same. In many instances, PennDOT will tar and chip a rural road because it has less traffic and will last a sufficient amount of time with tarring and chipping, where if they did that on an urban road, there'd be so much traffic, we'd wear it out in 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
They can get away with tarring and chipping or other kinds of processes on a rural road that doesn't have nearly as much traffic.
So the cheaper way is maybe cost efficient on the rural roads, maybe.
Yes.
And
the flip side of that, of course, is if you're in an area that has a lot of truck traffic because of business, those roads will still wear out quickly because of the lesser standard.
Hmm. So earlier this month, PennDOT decided not to spend about $200 million. Was the money in hand and they just didn't spend it? Or was it sort of appropriated or this was a wish list or what? Would you explain that?
The money was set aside 2 years ago to put $200 million into fixing about 900 miles of rural roads and bridges. Then Mother Nature stepped in last year and caused a bunch of landslides across the state.
So it wasn't just in the Pittsburgh area, these landslides?
Not at all. PennDOT had budgeted about $30 million to take care of landslides across the state. They had $125 million worth of costs last year, and they didn't get anywhere near to fixing all of them. So the money that was set aside for the rural roads was reprogrammed to handle an emergency situation with landslides.
Do we know if they increased their budget set aside for landslides for this year or this coming budget?
I'm told they doubled it.
From the original number, which was what, $30 million, And yet the cost of the landslides that they took care of was more than doubled, right?
Way more than doubled. They hope, and it's always a hope rather than anything you can plan for, that that's a one-time anomaly in the weather. I mean, when you have a 100-year flood, you don't expect it to happen five times in 10 years. It should only happen once every 100 years.
What did PennDOT tell you about whether this money, is it gone now, this $200 million? Could it be restored? If so, what would be the conditions to restoring that money for the rural roads?
It's unlikely that they will reappropriate the money directly for the rural roads, but Governor Wolf's office has stressed that they have this, what they're calling a new program, Restore Pennsylvania. They say that fixing the rural roads and bridges will become part of that program. That's supposed to be $4.5 billion spent over 5 years.
Yeah.
And in addition to rural roads and bridges, it'll include broadband and some other programs in those areas, along with some flooding improvements, et cetera.
Sounds good, but would you say that's kind of iffy? Because isn't this $4.5 billion funded by a severance tax? And Governor Wolf has failed four times in a row to get a severance tax through in his budgets.
Kevin, you always look at the details. Yes, that is indeed the case. The hope is that that money will be available, and they will use part of it on the rural roads and bridges. Time will tell.
Maybe that is a way for the governor saying, hey, look, I want to designate this money for not just the cities across the state, rural areas. Might drum up a little more support in the legislature for the severance tax, which would go to this Restore Pennsylvania.
It is not lost on the governor that there are more votes in rural areas than there are in urban areas in the legislature.
Ed Blazina reports on transportation for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Thanks, Ed.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Results from the primary elections have been certified. The head of the Allegheny County Republican Party is stepping down. It's time for our regular political news roundup with Chris Potter. He's the editor of WESA's Government and Accountability Team. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Kevin.
Let's start with another resignation that Senate Democrats want, but it's not happening yet. State Senator Dalen Leach. Chris, remind us why Democratic leaders want one of their own to get out.
This has been a long-running issue. Senator Leach, who is from the Philadelphia suburbs area, has been accused of a variety of acts of misconduct, ranging from harassment of female staffers and associates to more serious offenses. And there has been a sort of long-running investigation into his conduct. Yesterday, Senator Leach took it upon himself to release what's sort of being characterized as a draft report by an outside party to look into his behavior, found that there was the report that he released. Again, it's a draft. It's incomplete. But it basically says, although he engaged in inappropriate conduct, there's nothing here that would violate the law. He is now portraying that as a complete exoneration of himself. Senate Democrats just saying, no, hold on just a second.
So what's Jay Costa, the leader, the Democratic leader of the Senate, saying?
Jay Costa is saying, look, this goes beyond what Mr. Leach has told you. This is not a complete report. We believe that he has created a sort of hostile work environment for employees over the years and should step down. It was basically Mr. Leach who first put this out there, and then there was sort of a scramble on the Democratic side to say, no, this is more serious than you're being led to believe. He should step down. A few minutes before we went on the air here, the state Democratic Party, Nancy Patton Mills, the chair, who is from Allegheny County, as is Senator Costa, also added to that chorus and said Mr. Leach should step down. This has been sort of a long-running thing. Democrats want this to go away.
So it's building against Dalen Leach.
It is. There definitely seems to be a movement against it, but it's difficult to oust somebody if they don't want to go. So we'll see how it plays out.
So let's move on to someone who did resign. Dee Raja, How much pressure was he under to step down as the chair of the Allegheny County Republican Party?
Yeah, so if you talk to Raj about this, he'll say that, you know, he stepped down last just a few days after he announced his resignation as chair of the county committee just days after the primary. He says this was always his plan. You know, I always intended to step down. Republicans have a weird procedure whereby they choose their party leadership in a presidential election year. It makes it a little difficult. You have shifts in, you know, in who's running things in the very heat of a presidential campaign. He says he wanted to avoid that. The reporting I've done suggests there was a lot of discontent among local Republicans with the direction of the party.
How so? Some specifics? Not getting enough candidates to run, or what?
That's issue number one. If you look at people who do still remember the primary just last month, well, remember, if they were Republicans, there was a lot of blank space on their ballot. They did not have candidates on the ballot for any of the state or the countywide races, and a lot of the county council districts simply don't have any candidates either. So, you know, if you're a county committee chair, candidate recruitment is like supposed to be one of the top things you're doing. Also, let's remember that not long before the primary, Raja himself recruited himself as a candidate to run for state senate in the special election there. And a lot of Republicans wish he hadn't, because he lost that race. That's the second time he's lost that seat. So a lot of them are kind of looking back and saying, if Raja's not recruiting himself to run, he doesn't seem to be recruiting anybody else. The party's fortunes in Allegheny County have been lagging, even as in many ways they've been improving elsewhere in western Pennsylvania.
So realistically, can the new party leader do anything for the 2019 general, or is the focus going to be 2020?
Well, they can do a little. One thing that the Republicans did do is they did support a couple of successful write-in candidates. So Chelsea Wagner will apparently be facing Republican rival Brooke Nadonley, running for county controller. And there will be a candidate on the ballot in one of the council district races. But really, at this point, the ballot is pretty much set. These are kind of low interest races here. Maybe there can be a difference, but this is really about setting themselves up for 2020, and that's the real work of the party now.
A final quick note, Chris. One of the original members of county council, Mr. Martoni, died recently. Yeah. What becomes of his seat?
So right now, in a couple weeks, Democrats will select somebody to replace him. Charles Martoni was a Democrat, and under the county home rule charter, Democrats will pick his replacement. That replacement will hold the seat through November, when voters will pick a replacement to fill out the rest of his term.
Chris Potter is the leader of WESA's Government and Accountability Team. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you so much.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The 60th annual Three Rivers Arts Festival gets underway today. It features traditional favorites as well as a U.S. premiere of a dance performance on sort of a different stage and colorful sculptures made from flip-flops. WESA's arts and culture reporter Bill O'Driscoll is with us. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Kevin. How you doing?
All right, Bill, before we get to what's happening this year and looking forward to it, let's look back a little bit. 60 years. So what was the original idea behind the festival?
Well, the festival was started by something called the Women's Committee of the Carnegie Institute, which just wanted to bring art out into the streets a little bit, out of the walls of the institution and to the people.
Mm-hmm. How long was it originally? Did it get much attention, many fans?
The festival now says it ran for 4 days, the very first one back in 1960, and drew 28,000 people, which is many, many less than it draws now.
Maybe tenfold less.
Or like more, yeah.
So the festival through the years has brought in a lot of great performers, including one of my favorites, Ella. Any others strike you as you were doing your homework for your reporting?
Yeah, I mean, all kinds of great people have come through there. Philip Glass, the great composer, Doc Watson, the bluegrass guy, all kinds of people over the years. And more recently, you know, sort of iconic bands like Wilco and Sonic Youth have even been there.
Right. The length of the festival has changed. You said originally that 4 day one for the first one's changed through the years, hasn't it?
Yeah. At one point back in the 90s, folks will remember that it was like around 3 weekends. So it was like, was that 17 days or something like that? And then some years ago, they cut it back just because it was, you know, the expense and things like that. The Pittsburgh Cultural Trust took it over, I think it was about 10 years ago. And now it's been 10 days, two full weekends, and all the days in between for the past several years.
So let's get to what's happening this year. We have a U.S. premiere of a dance performance on a very different kind of stage. Tell us a little bit about that.
Right. This is a French troupe called Company Fourinkai. And they do this show called Origami, where they take a shipping container, one of these big metal boxes that goes on freighters, and they sort of retrofitted it so it unfolds like origami would, if you can imagine such a thing. The different pieces that are unfolding are connected by sort of tight ropes, and there's a dancer who performs on the thing. It's kind of a combination of dance, acrobatic, movement art.
Yeah, yeah. Do I understand there's like a tightrope involved, kind of?
Yeah, there's tightropes. I've only seen still pictures. I haven't seen any video, but it looks pretty spectacular. They're going to set this up right down at the point where the fountain is. So it'll going to have a spectacular kind of panoramic backdrop, and it should really be something. It's a half-hour show. They're not doing it this weekend, but they're doing it the second weekend of the festival, so like the 14th through the 16th, and there'll be five different showings of it.
All right. Looking forward to that. The festival often features public art installations, sculptures, but you reported there are sculptures made from flip-flops. Where do they come from?
Right. Well, this is a group called Ocean Soul Africa. They're based in Kenya. Flip-flops in the developing world are the most popular form of footwear, basically, because it's cheap. Unfortunately, a lot of them, when they get discarded, they end up in the ocean. What this group does is that they wash up on the beaches, these flip-flops. This group collects them and then makes them into sculptures. You know, they use different adhesives, they make them into big blocks, and they kind of carve them out. Makes these kind of fantastical looking sculptures of animals and different things. So there'll be several of these down in the point.
And flip-flops, as we know, come in all kind of different colors, so I assume these sculptures are pretty colorful.
They're very colorful. Yeah, I've seen pictures of them, and yeah.
So there's an environmental concept to this as well, recycling these things that just sort of wash up on the beach. So you're cleaning the beach, and you're making use of what's been discarded.
Yeah, that's the idea. It's an increasingly popular idea in the art world to reuse materials rather than using new stuff. Yeah, great idea.
So these sculptures are recognizable, what they represent. I understand. It's a giant giraffe, or a life-size giraffe?
Yeah, the animals, sculptures of animals are a big part of what they do, and supposedly there's going to be, what we can find out in 2 hours, you can make your way down to the point starting when the festival opens, but one of them is going to be a life-size giraffe, yeah.
Okay. Any music headliners that stand out to you this year?
Yeah, well, the festival starts tonight. India Ari is the soul music performer. She's going to be there tonight. She's the headliner tonight. There's also a band. The closing night act is Carl Denson's Tiny Universe, kind of a funk fusion act. The band Lucius, the band Tank and the Bangas. So there's a lot of Pittsburgh Symphony plays. So there's a really wide range of stuff that's happening.
Always new stuff, but some traditional favorites return, and such as?
Well,
the artist market, that kind of thing?
Oh, sure. All that stuff is there. Yeah, the artist market. Of course, your vendors of fried foods will all be there, you know, if you're looking for your fix there. I will put in a plug, too, for local artists showing at the festival. The Juried Visual Art Show, which I actually just got to see a preview of last night. Painting, sculpture, all kinds of different things by maybe 50 or so artists from the Pittsburgh region. Really good show. That's up on Liberty Avenue, not down in Point State Park. It's in a gallery up on Liberty Avenue, so that's one to check out, too.
So, don't forget, the festival can be spread out. It can be in different venues, if you would.
Correct. Mostly it's down in Point State Park and Gateway Center. That's where most of the live music and other performance stuff is, but there is stuff that goes up into the cultural district up Liberty Avenue there, too.
All right, Bill, in a sentence or two. To what are you most excited to see or hear?
I'm always up for the music stuff. I think it's great to have these free concerts that happen. It's a great atmosphere out there. So I'm going to say Tank and the Bangas. I've been wanting to see them for a while. That's next Friday night, the 14th.
All right. The Three Rivers Arts Festival kicks off tonight with art and performances, and it runs through June 16th. Bill O'Driscoll is WESA's arts and culture reporter. Thanks so much, Bill.
Thanks, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. The Confluence is taking a week off to plan for a summer full of conversations with fascinating individuals and discussions about issues vital to our community. We welcome your suggestions. Please email them to confluence at WESA.FM. And don't forget, you can catch up on past shows by visiting WESA.FM/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Julia Zenkovich, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.